In 1 Samuel chapter 17, the first three verses began a narrative that will be familiar to many of you. Verse 1 says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered in Socah, which belongs to Judah, for they encamped between Socah and Azekah in Ephes-Damon. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on one side of the mountain, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them." I didn't really need to read those verses, but I just wanted to impress upon you that I can pronounce those words. And now the story that follows is, again, a narrative that many of you are aware of. In chapter 15, we just read from chapter 17, but in chapter 15, King Saul, who is the king of Israel, has been rejected of God. That's not, I think, widely known in Israel. But in chapter 16, David has been now anointed by God to be the future king. But again, people don't know about that. They don't really know much about David. But here in chapter 17, David comes to the forefront of the nation of Israel. He becomes known because there has been this battle going on for over 40 years between the Philistines and the Israelites. The Philistines will attack, they'll get the upper hand for a while. The Israelites will fight back, they'll get the upper hand. And so this has been going on for quite some time, but at this moment the Philistines have the upper hand because they have a new weapon. His name is Goliath. He stands 9 feet tall. The vest that he wears weighs 125 pounds. The spear that he carries, the tip of that spear, weighs 15 pounds, or about the size of a bowling ball. This shield is the size of a picnic table, and every morning he comes out and yells over the valley we just read about, "Let's be peace-loving people. You send a fighter against me, and if I defeat him, we'll win. You'll serve us. If he defeats us, you'll win. We'll serve you." And every day he stands and he humiliates the nation of Israel because no one will go and fight. And it's within that scene that David shows up, the Bible says, delivering bread and cheese to his brothers. In other words, he's the pizza boy, the bread and cheese, that's pizza. So he brings the pizza to his brothers, and at that time, Goliath comes out and utters his challenge to the nation of Israel. And David is amazed. He looks around and he sees nothing but shivering, quaking men. He looks at this man and then he says to those around him, he says, if somebody were to challenge this man, what would happen to them if they won? And someone says, well, if he challenged him and won, he would get to marry the princess and he would not have to pay taxes the rest of his life, or his family would not have to pay taxes. And apparently they're all broke, so they don't care about the taxes, and they've seen the princess and she's not worth risking their life over. So they're all standing there quaking. And David says, who is this Philistine to challenge the army of God? And there's some criticism, which we're going to get to, of that statement. But sooner or later, David finds his way to the tent of King Saul. And he tells Saul that he is willing to fight the giant Goliath. Saul says, listen, you're too young. This isn't going to work. David says, well, listen, I've killed a lion, I've killed a bear, and then I am more than able to handle this gorilla. It's over there on the other side of the mountain. And so Saul says, all right, here's my armor. David puts it on, turns around 3 times in it, says, this isn't going to work. And he says, listen, I'm going to use what brought me here. I'm going to use my sling. So Saul says, well, you go, the Lord be with you. In other words, you go, we'll pray. While we're praying, we're going to be packing. But you go. So David goes out, faces the giant. The rest is history. Puts a stone in that sling, hurls it across, I don't know how far, but strikes the giant in the forehead. His eyes go blank. He falls. He's dead. The army of the Philistines is routed by the Israelites on that day. Now, as I reread that story, one of the things that jumped out at me this week is just how much criticism David faced between showing up with the bread and the cheese and winning the victory against Goliath. I mean, it's really a chronicle of pessimism, of criticism leveled at this man. Here he is. He wants to do something for the Lord. Nobody else is willing to do anything. He's the only one who's willing to step forward and try. And all through this narrative, all he gets is cold water poured upon him. And then I thought about all the other people in the Bible and in history who ever stood up and tried to do something for the Lord. And you know what? I think that they face the same thing. Everybody who's ever tried to do anything in this world has had to withstand the onslaught of criticism. Think of Nehemiah, reading there again this week. Nehemiah leaves a cushy job in the palace of Persia, and he's concerned about Jerusalem. The walls have been torn down. They lie there around. The city is defenseless. He wants to go and do something to rebuild the walls. He goes back, and with God helping him, he rebuilds the walls in 52 days. But all through that time, all through that miracle, there's criticism after criticism after criticism. Think of Jesus Christ even returning to his village after he has began his ministry, and they say, who is this? Is this not the carpenter's son? In other words, this ain't a prophet. This isn't a priest. This certainly isn't the Messiah. This is an apprentice, a carpenter. This is nobody. Everybody who does something for the Lord has to face criticism. Anybody who does anything of value has to face criticism. I think of the people who started this nation and the criticism that they endured. I think of the people who started this church 114 years ago, and it had very small beginnings in a little storefront downtown, as I understand it. Very humble beginnings. And I can't imagine the criticism that people who started faced, wondering why you would start there, start now. Why don't you just go join another church? Why do you want to step out in faith and do something new? I think about even your family. You know what? Your family, if you have a great family, started because a man and a woman, probably no more than a boy or a girl, somewhere back down in history, looked at each other and said, I don't know if we can, but let's try anyway. And I'm sure that somewhere somebody said, I don't want this guy as a son-in-law. And somebody looked at him and said, surely you can do better than her. But somewhere along the way, they stepped out in faith, and you and I are the recipients of two people who did something wonderful, stepping out in spite of the criticism. Industrialists have had to face that. Again, I'm old enough now to remember when Steve Jobs said, I can get people to buy a new phone every 2 years, and people laughed at him. And people didn't believe him, because if they believed him, they would have mortgaged their houses and bought Apple stock when he said that, and they'd be retired right now. But they didn't believe that, because we had grown up with a phone fastened to the wall. And if you wanted to have a private conversation, you had to yell at everybody to get out of the room. And then you got this phone with a cord that would sometimes go 20, 30 feet so you could leave the room and shut the door. And then you got a phone that you could carry around. It was a cordless phone, and you knew you were middle class when you had a cordless phone. But you still weren't upper class because the upper class people had a car phone or a portable phone they carried around in this briefcase, and it weighed 20 pounds. And when you saw them, you thought they were calling in the Air Force to drop bombs because they were carrying this phone. But they were the upper class people of our day. And then Steve Jobs comes and he says, no, phones are going to take the place of computers someday. Laptops. And by the way, when I go out and I've got my laptop sitting in a coffee shop working on a sermon, I look around and feel like a dinosaur because everybody's on their phones and tablets, but I need a keyboard to get my work done. But he said the phone will replace all the other electronics, and it has revitalized our culture. Somebody said, you know the difference in a cell phone or cell phones and human beings? Cell phones are getting slimmer and smarter. That's the difference between cell phones and human beings. And they are. But I can remember the criticism, again, that he faced in bringing his ideals to the market. Everybody will face criticism if they step out to do anything. And you will face added criticism if you step out with a vision that God gave you and you want to bring that vision to fruition. And some of you are here today and you don't get that. God has given you a vision. God has given you a mission. God has given you a view of what your life can be, a life of victory, a life of contentment, a life of peace. He's given you a vision maybe of being an overcomer with your addiction, of putting it down once and for all and having a testimony that you have victory over that. Maybe he's given you a vision of your family, of having a godly family, of having a wife, of having children that serve the Lord. Maybe he's given you a vision of something to be done in this church or in the kingdom of God that will change the world. Maybe he's just really looked at you and said, listen, you can be more than you are. Your whole family has been nominal believers. Your whole family have been religious in name only, but they haven't had a fiery, deep relationship with me. But I'm calling you to have a deep relationship that just isn't a little bit of church attendance, just isn't a little bit of doing the right thing and saying the right thing, but I'm calling you to have a deep connection with me, and you haven't seen that in your family, but I am calling you to that. I'm calling you to be a real believer, a real person of faith. Yes. And everybody around you says, oh, that ain't never going to happen. You're not going to do that. You'll never overcome that. I mean, some of you, I think, might be surprised. You look at your life and you say, all my life, I've done bad. I haven't done right. I haven't tried. But now I'm trying. Now I'm working to do right. And everybody's criticizing me. They weren't criticizing me when I was trying to do wrong. But now that I'm trying to do right, they're pointing out all the inconsistencies in my life. But I'm still growing. You're surprised by that. Don't be surprised. When you set out to do something for Jesus Christ, when you set out to do something for God, you will face criticism. Look at what David faces. They come against him. The first thing, or not the first thing, but one of the things they say is, you're too young. Look at verse 33. Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth and he a man of war from his youth. I don't know why we say that to people sometimes. It's not the right time in your life. This isn't the right time. It's the wrong season for you to be trying to do what you're doing for the Lord. Wait a little bit. Just wait a little bit. Youth has always found scorn. That's why Paul had to say to Timothy, let no one despise your youth. If God is calling you, you're old enough. If God is with you, you're old enough. Sometimes when we look at why Jesus was rejected, We look at the claims that he made, and we look at the stances that he made, and the impossibility that people saw in a crucified Messiah. I think one thing that doesn't always cross my mind that might have also been at play was that he's 30 years old. His disciples, we assume, are all younger than him, maybe early 20s. And I wonder if they looked at Jesus and these disciples and said, they're too young. I mean, what do they know? And then Jesus ascends, and the whole church is ran by a bunch of guys in their 20s. I wonder if that caused people to say, you know, if these guys were in their 50s, it'd be one thing. But these guys aren't old enough to know anything. And you will always face criticism if you're young that you're too young. You'll also face criticism, by the way, if you're too old. If you're too old. It goes both ways. But listen to me. You are never too old to pursue God's vision for your life. Moses was 80 when he was called in the desert. And you say, 80 was young then. No, 80 was still old back then. He would have been better at 40 to do what God had called him to do. But he's older. He's 80. Caleb's taken mountains when he's in his 80s. Samuel's old when he's still serving the Lord. It doesn't matter how old you are either. You can still do what God is calling you to do. I love this scene in 2 Samuel chapter 17. David's been king for a long time. He's 57 years old as far as anybody can count. He might be older, but he's at least 57 when you count ages of kids and that sort of thing. And his son Absalom rebels against him and gets the majority of the soldiers to join him to fight against David. And David has to flee Jerusalem, and he flees with his oldest soldiers, the ones who had been with him all the way back when he was in his 20s. And Absalom is there trying to figure out whether now is the time to attack David. And one guy gets up and he says, now's the time to attack. Go get him. You got him on the run. He's tired. He's worn out. He's with a bunch of old guys. And then another guy stands up named Hushai, and he's supposed to give bad advice, but I think what he says is absolutely true. He says, no, don't go after him now, because he's old, and the guys with him are old, but they're mean. And you're going to go up against them, and he says, it's going to be like going up against a mama bear who's lost her cubs. They might be old, they may not be what they once were, but they're as good once as the song go as they've ever been. You don't want to go up against those guys. And when you read about his mighty men, how one guy in one battle killed 800 people with a spear. Those are old guys, but you didn't want to mess with them. They could still take out the 20-somethings. And age has nothing to do with it if God is on your side and God is calling you. That's what I'm trying to tell you. They say to David, you're too young. They say something else, and this comes from his brother Eliab. Look at this. Look at that handsome man. No, I'm joking. Then one of the servants answered and said, look. Let's go to verse 28 if you can. Yeah. Now Eliab, his older brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger, this is David saying, what's somebody going to get if they kill this guy? Eliab hears this, his older brother. And his anger was aroused against David, and he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. Now, there's a lot wrapped up in that. But basically, he says, David, you're carnal. You don't have good motives. You're coming down here. You're nothing but a shepherd, and you only got a few sheep. And you're coming down here, and I know your pride. It's pride that's motivating you. It's not good motives. you come down here and you see this as an opportunity to maybe make a name for yourself. And you're nosy anyway. Who told you to come down here? Why don't you just go home? And this is coming from his brother. His brother saying, listen, you don't have good motives. You have a bad spirit about you. You're nosy. It's none of your business anyway. And you're only trying to do something to make a name for yourself. And what's interesting is that Eliab, he ain't doing nothing. And the people that will criticize you for trying to do something and will question your motives and go after you and go after your spirit and go after your qualifications, they're usually the people that aren't doing anything. The person who's saying, you'll never lay the bottle down, you'll never get sober, he's the guy who can't stay sober himself. The guy who's sitting around saying, hey, you'll never have a good marriage, it'll never work, it's not meant to be. They've done been married and divorced 4 times. That's where that's coming from. The people who are sure that your kids aren't going to stay out of prison when they grow up, they don't have any kids. And so David has to take this onslaught from his family. And maybe you're there, by the way. Maybe the most criticism you're facing now in trying to do what God wants you to do is coming from your own family. It's coming from people that you thought would be supportive of you, people that you thought would have your back, and they're the ones saying, you don't have the right motive, you don't know what you're doing, you're dumb, you're stupid, you're nosy, you need to forget about what God has put on your heart. Something else here comes from the giant. When he finally gets to Goliath, Goliath says, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? In other words, Saul says, you're too young. This isn't the right time for you. Eliab says, you don't have the right motives and it's none of your business anyway. The giant says, you don't have what it takes to take me. You got sticks and you got stones. That's about all you got. You don't have what it takes. So here is David, and he's getting no encouragement. He's risking his life. There's nobody lining up to give him high fives. There's nobody patting him on the back. There's no victory celebration lining up to be ready when he wins. There's no support from his family. He doesn't have anything that from anybody that would encourage him to continue. But David did have some things. First thing David had was a dream. He had a vision. He saw that this was possible. God had put it in him to dream this. He wanted his people to be delivered from the Philistines. God had put it on his heart, and he wanted to follow that. He had fire in his belly. He had a determination. He had a drive inside of him. In spite of what everybody was saying, in spite of the critics in his life, he had a fire and a dream. And that causes him, by the way, to use restraint. Because when they come after him, when his brother came after him with those vile accusations, David doesn't say a thing. He just lets it go. When Saul comes after him or questions his youth, he defends himself. But he's not harsh. He's not hostile. He could have come after particularly his brother and said, well, that's big talk from you standing here. You're not doing anything. Look at you, you big coward, you bunch of bums. Look at you all standing there shaking. At least I'm trying to do something. He could have said that, and it'd have been true. But that's not what he said, because he had this fire, he had a dream, he had a determination, and his eyes were focused on the goal. Not only did he have a dream, but he had a love for God. He loved God. In fact, in verse 26 and 36 and 45, he says the same thing. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine to defy the armies of the living God? Someone said, a commentator said facetiously, he said, that's what David had going for him. He says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Everybody else was looking at him from the waist up. David was looking at him from the waist down and said, this guy, he doesn't have a commitment with God. He doesn't have the favor of God. He's not in relationship with God. How is he able to stand here and defy the armies of the living God? I love God. I'm out to defend God's name. I want to see God glorified on this battlefield. That's what's driving me. It's not pride. It's glorification of God. Yes. Not only did he have a dream, not only did he have a great love for God, but he had a great faith in God. He believed that if he got to the battlefield, God would be with him. And I like what he finally says to the giant. He finally lets go. He says, and David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. You trust in the Lord. He says, if I go, God will be with me. Now, when I have preached this passage in the past, I'll point something out, and I want to point it out here in these last few moments. When we picture ourselves in this scene, we often picture ourselves maybe as David. That ought not be. We're probably the cowardly guys lined up saying, what are we going to do about this mess? That's oftentimes where we are in our life. We have fear. We're facing this thing. We're facing the criticism, and it's pushing back on us. What they needed was David to stand up and fight for them. Now, this is what the Bible says. The shepherd said in Luke chapter 1:32 that Jesus would reign on the throne of David. Acts chapter 2 says that Jesus has now sit down at the right hand of the Father, which is the throne of David. And I like Revelation 5:5 if you've got it. This is a picture of what was happening in the Bible before Jesus Christ came. This is around the throne. It says, but one of the elders said to me, do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scrolls and to loose its seven seals, or to bring about the plan of salvation. Listen to me. They had their David. We have our David, and his name is Jesus Christ. He is the son of David. He is our David. So we don't have to go to battle alone. David fought for them. The son of David fights for us. And if you have a dream, if you love Jesus, then you can trust that Jesus Christ, if he's put it in your heart, will help you bring it to fruition. Nobody else may believe it. Nobody else may be on your side. Nobody else in your family thinks that you're going to live for the Lord, thinks that you're going to amount to much for the Lord, thinks that you're going to defeat that addiction, thinks that you're going to have a godly family. But if Jesus Christ is for you, you're going to win that fight. I like what Gene Sibilla said to a student once. Gene Sibilis was a great composer, and he had a student, and the student was playing piano and mangled it and got booed. And Gene Sibilis went over and put his hand on the student's shoulder and said, son, just remember, there's not a city in the world who's built a statue to a critic. Not a city in the world with a statue to the critics. listen to me. You're going to have to look at your critics, and I don't know that I would say it, but I would say, listen, if God be for me, your criticism ain't going to matter. If God be for me, who can stand against me? My heart's in the right place. I love the Lord. He has put a dream in my heart. And He, if He'll fight with me, and He will fight with me because I love Him and the dream came from Him, is going to stand with me regardless of what people are saying about me. And you're going to have to stand. Think about what would happen. Stand with me. Think about what would happen if David had been in the place where he listened to the critics. What would have happened in the life of David if he would have said, you know what, Saul, you're right, I am young. You know, right, you're right, brother. Maybe my heart's not in the right place. You know what, Goliath? I don't think I'm up to this. What would have come of David? Would we be reading about David now? That was a crucial moment in his life where he had to look at a whole host of people who didn't think he was able to do it. And weren't shy about telling him that he wasn't up to it. And he had to believe that God was able to deliver him in that moment. And you might be there. No family support. No help. No encouragement. But if you've got God, you've got enough. You've got enough. Maybe today you'd like to come and just reaffirm your commitment to Him.